red leather, yellow leather, red leather, yellow leather.
That actually kind of works for me.
Whatever. Whatever you have to do.
Bing bong on ting tong. That's not one. I just made that
up. Okay. Welcome to another episode of Jabber on the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are Richard Wally.
And from California, the Los Angeles area, you are Cassidy Robinson.
Yes. How is Portland handling the El Nino?
Oh, I don't think we've even noticed it. Hasn't really been a thing.
It doesn't make a difference over there?
It's supposed to, I think. A couple of weeks ago, she said it was supposed to be super cold. And if you're talking about like snow, like, yeah, they don't do snow here. Like, I mean, they literally don't go outside of their homes. They shut down businesses. It becomes an apocalypse here.
Right.
I'm not kidding. A quarter of an inch. But no, it's been like 45 to 50 degrees most days. It's been pretty tame.
Okay. We're probably about the same right now, then. We've evened out where your Cate Blanchett meets my Brad Pitt in the middle of Benjamin Button.
Okay. I haven't seen that film, so...
Everybody gets it.
I don't know if anybody got that. Even people who saw the film.
I guess... Okay, first of all, I'm putting off the inevitable. We have to talk about it. Because we have a podcast that is about the media... we have to talk about, we haven't recorded in a little while, actually. We released our top 10 last week, but we actually recorded that 2 weeks ago, the same time we recorded our other.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, like 1,000 celebrities have died.
It's true.
I mean, there's been very high profile ones and we'll talk about that, but
we should probably record more often, I think is what that means. People are dying because of us, Cassidy.
It's like clapping for Tinkerbell. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What? You're saying crazy shit today. I don't understand you.
I might be on mescaline. Don't worry about it.
Am I getting old? Is that what's happening?
No. Okay. So here's the deal. David Bowie died. He became the star baby at the end of 2001. And Alan Rickman more recently. Yeah. By a couple days or so.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously sad. I was actually really taken aback by the David Bowie thing. Both of them were, I think, pretty quiet about their illness. They weren't very public about it, and they were both fairly active. I mean, David Bowie released an album only like 2 days before he died. Of course, then everyone went back and listened and went, "Oh, this is an I'm dying record."
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, pretty much. It's pretty much a eulogy to himself that he wrote. Every song is sort of, I mean, it's a darker record in general, and every song is kind of alluding to death in some way. But I saw the news when I went, it was like, you know, posted around midnight or so, and I was just kind of, it was on a Sunday, and I was going to my work email to make sure that, you know, there wasn't anything I didn't do or da 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 before I had to go in on Monday. And I saw, like, all of a sudden a thread got started between a few of my coworkers who were like, "Wait a minute, they're saying David Bowie died." And I was like, "What? Bullshit." And then I like quickly went online and did the big search. You know, when you don't want somebody to be dead, so you try and find as many sources as possible just to corroborate the story. And at first there wasn't. I mean, that's how quick the news was. And I was like, and in fact, there was even a story by like a British tabloid or something that was like, you know, rumors that David Bowie's had died are false, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay. So then I was waiting. And then, of course, I knew it was real when Duncan Jones, who the director of Moon and Source Code, posted a baby photo of him and his dad on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And confirmed it, essentially. And yeah, it was a big bummer. I was a fan. I have a few David Bowie records that I listened to after. And obviously, he's not as well known for it, but he appeared in films. We reviewed the one he did with Nicholas Roeg, The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Yeah, we did.
Which is super weird.
Yeah, I don't think I reviewed it very well, so...
No, I don't think I did either. I'd be willing to look at it again, though. I feel like it was more of a failing on my part than the movies. All I remember now is at the end, he peels off his face and he's a lizard. But obviously probably most famous for playing the Goblin King in The Labyrinth. But he was also one of my favorite roles was him in The Prestige as Nikolai Tesla.
Mm.
That was fun. Or he did a really good job in Basquiat as Andy Warhol.
Right.
So, and he was in the Twin Peaks Fire Walk with Me, and he's appeared in several strange little films there, you know, walk on roles like he did in Zoolander. So yeah, I don't know.
He has a persona bigger than him.
Yeah. Which is why everyone made not even the joke per se, but the tribute or whatever, saying that, you know, he didn't die. He just sort of transcended or became, you know, went back home to his home planet and that kind of stuff. Cause he was always. Yeah,
he was part of his first persona, and he's he kind of has that weird joke surrounding himself too. I keep thinking of the Flight of the Conchords, which is maybe mildly inappropriate, but you know,
no, that's where I'm at. I actually saw some people post that clip because it is a loving tribute, even though. And what's strange is the way they're talking about him in that is almost like he was already dead.
That's true.
Like. Because he's like a ghost of Christmas past, like the way they use him in that episode.
So this really affected you. You're like pouring your heart out through
it
film.
It kind of did. You know, it was a bigger bummer than I'm used to with celebrity deaths. And there has been a lot as of recently, including, and now we'll move on, Alan Rickman.
Yeah. That one hit me a lot more profoundly. I mean... Mm-hmm. I've watched Die Hard since I was a kid, but I mean, he's just always been a great actor that's been around, and it doesn't matter what he's in, he's always been good. So it was just sad to see, you know, Hans Gruber go off that building for the last time.
Right. And what's kind of strange is him and Bowie. And then if you want to roll it in, Lemmy Kilmister from Motorhead, who died a few, a week or so before both of them,
mm-hmm.
All around the same age, all around their birthdays. Kind of weird. All British.
All around 69, too, people were saying.
Yeah, around 69, 70, 71, something like that. I mean, you know, both Bowie and especially Lemmy, I think were kind of famous for living hard.
Mm-hmm.
Lemmy, he looked 50 when he was 30. But yeah, no, all three of them, where I was going is, they're all kind of, I don't know what you would, kind of alternative icons in a way. They're all kind of offbeat and sort of left of center and sort of oddball characters.
Well, I think a lot of the kids knew Alan Rickman as
Snape
at this point. But I mean, he was also
I remembered him specifically from Dogma, I think was my first introduction to him. Well, Die Hard originally, but
A lot of people are bringing up the Robin Hood movie with Kevin Costner.
Yeah, Prince of Thieves.
Is that a big thing? I thought people dismissed that movie as not very good at one point, but it seems like a lot of people are bringing it up recently.
It's a guilty pleasure, I think, for most people. I think it's not good, but it's one that, it's a nostalgia thing, and it's kind of fun. It's not good in the right way.
Well, the one I was going to bring and up actually was Galaxy Quest.
Galaxy Quest is very good, yeah, and he's very good in it.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of those British actors who just brought his A game to anything he was in. He was in a lot of schlock, no doubt about it. But
that's why I was more sad. Any of those guys who go, I'm like, oh man.
He did direct a film briefly before he died. A kind of period piece where everyone was wearing wigs. I don't remember what it was called. But yeah, it's sad.
It is, and we're like the worst people to eulogize.
Yeah.
You it's funny because you hide yours through like talking about stuff. He was in this and he was in this. And I do it through humor. So yeah, don't listen to our eulogies.
Let's get into the movie news. We actually have a bunch because we haven't done this in 2 weeks, so it's built up a little bit. We'll do a couple stories. I'll let you start.
Okay, let's start off with Joe Hill. His novel Fireman has recently, Fox has kind of picked it up and they've been shopping around for a little bit, and they just attached Louis Leterrier to it.
Who's Joe Hill for people who might not know?
Oh, yeah. I forget. There's you guys out there. Joe Hill is a horror writer. I know him mostly from like his comic kind of stuff, like comic book, excuse me, like Lock and Key and Nosferatu, which is also his books. But his book series, he has like Ghost in a Box, also Nosferatu and The Fireman. Maybe for more our more scene illiterate friends out there, Horns was adapted from one of his books. Not a very good movie, but there it is. So Joe Hill, he's also known as, a lot of people give him crap because he's Stephen King's kid, but he's actually really earned it, and he's written some really strong, good stuff. So,
and Louis Leterrier, I think, is probably best well known for having directed the first Transporter film, and he also, I mean, might have did the second one as well. And then he did the Marvel reboot of the Hulk, with Edward Norton, The Incredible Hulk, and then Clash of the Titans, and Now You See Me most recently, and I think there's going to be a sequel to that.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's doing it. He might be. Probably. What else is he doing? But no, he's kind of a action-y...
Workman's like, director, I would say.
Yeah.
Not a ton of style, but he stays busy, and he works on this kind of level of action movie kind of stuff.
Well, I'll say for his sake, I think that his films are a little bit more for kind of workman action kind of guy. He brings a lot of energy. There's a lot of crackle. I don't know why I use that word. I feel very strange.
I think he sort of comes from the Luc Besson school of thought.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I'm not just saying that because of the French thing, but there is that same kind of like excitable schlock genre for its own sake kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, let's see if this would lend to his kind of style or lack thereof, from some people's viewpoint. Basically this is a big pandemic kind of thing that happens. And basically it's a spore that makes people catch on fire. And
spontaneously combust.
Yeah. I'm not really seeing too much more about like why it's called the fireman or anything like that. But
I think there's like a superhero-ish person involved who like is trying to get down to the bottom of it with a bunch of kids. Like, it has kind of like a Hunger Games-y sort of vibe to it as well. Like, because I think there's like this main like guy who's called the fireman, and this group of kids who are like trying to like find out the source of this pandemic.
Yeah, and here it just says a group of heroes led by an enigmatic man. I was like, well, that's really, that's enigmatic kind of writing right there. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know. The premise, I could, you know, I think it has potential. And I don't think that Louis Leterrier is necessarily like a complete hack or anything like that. I think that he turns out a pretty good product. So I don't know. This could be interesting. It just depends on what direction it goes in and how strongly it's adapted. Because some adaptations just don't necessarily work very well. And I didn't really think Horns worked super well. Mm-hmm. So,
although, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I haven't seen as many of his films, but I think Alexander Aja is a better director. Maybe that's six in one, half a dozen the other.
Well, I think he's one of those guys that started out really strong, and then I don't know if I necessarily agree with that anymore. But I mean I love High Tension, and then I thought his reboot of Alexander Aja's reboot of The Hills Have Eyes was pretty good. But there's a lot of his other remakes and stuff like that that I'm kind of like, eh, so much about.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that.
It's more style over substance, but
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really have a dog in the hunt. I'm kind of vaguely interested in Joe Hill as a person, as an entity, and to see how, you know, because a lot of great movies came out of Stephen King stuff. So maybe that would be cool if, you know, we could get something on that level with Joe Hill's work, but we'll see. Okay, my first story. Aaron Sorkin is set to do his directing debut on a poker princess movie called Molly's Game. So Aaron Sorkin, the writer of Steve Jobs, It Just Happened, and he also wrote the Social Network and the television's Newsroom and The West Wing. He's going to be directing his first film for Amy Pascal and Sony, based on a true story about this skier named Molly Bloom. So yeah, after failing to make the Olympics, she took a year off before law school and accepted a job as a waitress in Los Angeles. She put her entrepreneurial skills to good use and eventually found her way into running high-stakes poker games for Hollywood's elite 8 years before the FBI brought her down. Okay, so it's kind of a... sounds like it's kind of a Flew Too Close to the Sun story to some extent. But then it's also, like, it could... maybe vaguely interesting because she, like, you know, put her dreams on hold and tried to make money doing this illegal thing. So I could see Sorkin, you know, Sorkin really loves main characters who are sort of morally divided in that way. Or as of late he has. And so it kind of fits into his wheelhouse. I can see what maybe brought him to the project. I'm interested to see what he does as a director, because I have no sense of what he can do visually.
Right.
But, because I don't think he's ever, I don't think he's even directed television before. Maybe he's done some of the episodes of Newsroom or West Wing or Studio 60 or any one of his number of television shows.
Well, being a creator, a TV show is a little, it gives you a little bit more of a clue on how to direct, maybe than like a normal producer would. Well, I mean, that's maybe, but I mean, cause they do have to be within the, a show's creator does a lot of creative work and they put together a lot of things and they are kind of the person that kind of steers the ship in a lot of ways. So, I mean, he does have, I think, at least some similar-ish kind of credentials in that way.
He's been around long enough, and he's usually, his stuff is, you know, unlike a lot of writers who they write their stuff and they throw it out there, it gets bought, and then they're never on set again. And that, you know, they might never even get a phone call until award season if they, you know, if they're lucky enough. But Sorkin's kind of different. Like, his stuff is so specific and his dialogue is so dense that he's usually on set. Like, a lot of directors will keep him there and kind of consult with him always. Even if they want to, like, add a new line or they want to, like, rewrite a scene, they'll usually have him do it rather than hiring other writers.
Well,
I mean, he's also been a script doctor for stuff like The Rock and a few other movies.
Right. But, well, I mean, the first thing I thought of actually when I heard that, you know, this news was, oh, it'll be interesting to see how his, because something that he's really known for is his specific type of dialogue. And the first thing I thought was like, oh, it'd be interesting to see what his dialogue sounds like with him directing it. And to me, that's kind of like, you know, an Alex Garland directing. It's of enough note to be like, okay, yeah, I'll check that out just to see what it's like. I mean, maybe it won't be as, you know, as good as Ex Machina was, but regardless, I think he has enough merit as a writer for me to, like, you know, just be like, yeah, I'll definitely check this out. So.
And it might be interesting to see how, you know, a lot of people, they feel so beholden to his screenplays because they're so specific and they're so densely written. And I think they feel like it's like Shakespeare. They don't want to touch it. You know, like they're kind of precious about it. Whereas he might be a lot less precious with his own material if he's the director. He might be a lot more forgiving with the actors. He could be a lot of things. It could be wildly different than when somebody adapts his work.
I wonder if it's going to be a lot light. I kind of doubt that just because as a showrunner, he's kind of done that position.
Yeah,
and I mean, his shows seem like his shows. You don't say, oh, that's a whatever Joe Schmo TV show. You go, yeah, oh, no, that's an Aaron Sorkin show. So yeah, I think
you know that, it immediately.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, it'll probably be very similar. I think the biggest difference between TV and film is with TV, yes, you're breaking up into episodic pieces, but you're really telling a 12-hour story. Whereas with a movie, you're telling an elemental 2-hour something or other. So you really have to kind of boil it down to its elements. But we've seen that through great directors. So I can't see it not being at least like a middling, like decent. Yeah. So yeah. I'm there mostly.
What's your last one?
My last one, I'm kind of rolling together a little bit, but Guillermo del Toro, he's always known as having all these projects, kind of all these plates spinning to try to just get something made. Which for most directors is kind of like that. Recently James Cameron has been trying to get a remake of the 1966 film, A Fantastic Voyage, where they take a submarine and they basically go inside somebody's, and they shrink it down and go inside somebody's human body.
I think that was a Harryhausen thing, wasn't it? The original one?
It could be, but honestly, so I don't think so, but maybe. You should go look that up. I could see Guillermo del Toro taking this and taking it in some interesting ways. I mean, he's already really, really interested in, like anatomy and how the body works and what happens. Like, I mean, even in his most like, B schlocky horror, like something like The Strain, it goes into in depth on how the body works. And how, you know, even how his like vampires are created, they go into ridiculous detail of, oh, this is the stinger proboscis comes out from this place and blah, blah, blah. And so this could be a really interesting direction. And to have the horror element, I don't know, maybe it's a body horror, kind of stripped away, it might be a little bit more interesting because I do know that he has. He's expressed interest in doing things outside of just the horror or monster realm. So I think this could be an interesting, and with his visuals and his strange sense of storytelling, I think it could be a really fun. There could be a really cool movie inside of this. And he's a kind of director that I'd be like, okay, you're remaking something. I'm going to assume you have a reason. So
right, and it's an old enough movie, and I think, you know, it's kind of a broad science fiction thing, so it's not like remaking Casablanca or something like that. But I was wrong. Harryhausen has nothing to do with this. Although I did see this movie. I remember specifically the scene where they're in the little ship in the guy's body, and then their ship is attacked by antibodies. And they look like giant donuts kind of like sucking on the sides of their ship.
Yeah, I haven't. I mean, honestly, I have seen this film, but it hasn't been since I was a kid, so I need to go back to it. I do remember exactly what you're talking about, and that's about it. It does have a very funky, like, 1960s kind of science fiction element to it, like a forbidden planet or something like that. But
What's the other one that's
a little bit more, I guess people would say more stereotypical of him is adapting the scary stories to tell in the dark. So the Alan Schwartz trilogy of like little horror tales that were accompanied by these really quite dark illustrations. I remember getting it from the story and picking up because of those illustrations. And the stories, the stories do actually go very well with them.
Well, the stories are kind of like sparsely written, you know, they're kind of just like campfire tales, pretty much, you know, just direct accounts, like nothing, there's not a lot of flair to it style-wise.
Well, it's kind of minimal almost, but yeah, like in a way that makes it worse.
It's written for kids, so they're not very densely written. I think the max page count for one of those stories is like 5 or 6. And a lot of them are like 2 pagers and that kind of stuff. But the artist, whose name I don't know, unfortunately, who worked on those books, or at least a good amount of them, it was probably
his last name is Gamble.
I remember looking. It is chilling.
I don't think that they are. I think that they're Stephen Gamel is the artist's name. Yeah. I see. They are. His stories are very chilling and they're scary. But see, that's what drew me to them. Is they are kind of haunting in the best way. Those blacks really kind of, that minimalist black and white like look just really drew you in and really were like, oh my. Yeah. I don't think so. I think that I think that it's very true to, you know, the horror roots and letting, you know, you see the letting not necessarily see the monster, but letting you see the horrificness of it. And honestly, I mean, tying this back into like with Guillermo del Toro and all of that, doing this as like some kind of like, I don't know, either I could see it as 3D or claymation, like Kia kind of. I don't think it'll be like Kia because I think it's through somebody else. But I could see this very much coming to life through his art and kind of having that sweeping black style. Going back to Harry Potter, there was those little cutaway, and I think it was
Deathly Hallows Part One.
Yeah, Deathly Hallows Part One.
Yeah,
and
I've done like paper cutout sort of style.
Yeah, and it worked in a cinematic way, and I think that this could work because I mean, there's already a precedent with it within horror to do vignettes, you know, or you know, a movie full of just like little tiny stories. I mean,
if right, we're talking Creepshow, that was what I was concerned with mostly with this story because when we first heard that there was going to be a Goosebumps movie,
mm-hmm.
I thought the obvious way to do that would to do it as vignettes,
mm-hmm.
because then you could include either well-known stories or kind of different takes on them or whatever, and they ended up turning it into, I don't even know what, Jumanji with Goosebumps characters. It looked really silly, and they went really broad and comedic with it, and I'm afraid that they'll do the same thing here, rather than do an anthology film, which would make sense because the books are anthology books.
Well,
and the stories are so short anyway.
The reason I wouldn't assume that is just because of who's doing them. Right. I mean, if they do, I still don't think that he would take the teeth away from it. I mean, when Guillermo del Toro even announced this, he posted the art of the original Stephen Grimmel. Like he literally bought in his little house of horrors he has. Tucked away in yeah. LA, wherever he has these, he has the original art from some of the pages in his house. So right, I mean,
like framed, yeah,
yeah. So I don't see that happening. Him like detoothing it and making it some broad comedy. I see him, you know, even though with kids, you don't right now, you don't really see a lot of stuff that you know straight up tries to scare them or be like that. I don't feel like he would. I don't feel like he would go that route and go like a broad humor sort of thing.
No,
some of them have a dark humor to them too. I do remember that because I remember reading one of them and kind of chuckling. And I think that was maybe my first foyer into dark humor was these.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of them are the way they're written. They're kind of, there is like a punchline usually
mm-hmm.
because they're really really short stories. So that's kind of, you know, the structure is kind of a build up and then a punchline.
Well, I remember it being some of them are like almost like condensed Poe stories.
Yeah,
where they've got kind of a creepy.
Some of them were even like just poetry or like a song or whatever. Right. And I mean, they were considering what they were and who they were written for. They were kind of experimental. Yeah, I won't go over the top with that description, but I think that there was something kind of loose and then of course it has the appeal of being scary stories and having that insanely terrifying art. But I'm curious as to what age we're skewing for here, because these books were written for kids. And I think that whoever's developing it probably wants it to be appropriate for kids.
Well, a 5 to 10.
And I wonder how much he can get away with in that realm.
Well, I think if we go for like I don't think something like A Nightmare Before Christmas or something would be that far out. I mean, if you think about Nightmare Before Christmas, there's like a tree with skeletons like hanging by nooses from it. You can hide these kind of things for kids. As long as you're not explaining, look how we killed and murdered this person. Like there are ways to hide the macabre and go for it full without, you know,
yeah,
without going too far and being like, look at this, he ate him. Well, I don't know. I think that is one of the stories. Anyways,
if it's done in animation or if it's done in puppetry, you can get away with more as well.
That's true.
Okay. So. Well, let's go ahead and get into our reviews for the week. And the first movie that we're going to be reviewing is Alejandro González Iñárritu's The Revenant, which we wanted to catch up with. But it's only recently opened wide within January, so it's actually, for most people, not that old.
Well,
of a release.
January, people have, you know, got pushed into the theaters so much in December that sometimes people let movies go for a little bit longer. So it might still be very new for people.
Do you want to go ahead and set this up?
So The Revenant is basically, you know, frontiersmen, some people that were fur trapping on the, you know, out on the Old West, but the real Old West, not like, you know, like John Wayne kind of fantasy land, but an actually scary, snowy West. Basically, they're hunting beavers and they get attacked by Indians. They go on the run and Leonardo DiCaprio's character gets attacked by a bear. He's in critical condition. You see just the harshness of these environments. And one of the other characters, played by Tom Hardy, wants to survive at all costs. And he kind of schemes his way into being left alone with him, and then basically kills him, almost kills him, setting him off on, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio's character on this big vengeance trip. It's basically a vengeance story told in a very realistic West setting. I thought it was
in like the Intermountain West, not like the Southwest.
Yeah, because that definitely changes it. No, they shot around Canada. They tried to use natural lighting. They ended up having to go to Patagonia because stuff didn't work out. There was a lot of news surrounding this movie. Leonardo DiCaprio's performance is very, very good. He doesn't speak much, but the but he speaks a lot with his, you know, his face and his expressions, and I can't say anything about the performances. Tom Hardy was a Tom Hardy villain in this. He was a bastard. You didn't want to trust him. He uglied up a little bit.
I'd say everyone did.
Yeah, everybody did in this. But essentially, oh yeah, one other character, I guess, there's also Domhnall Gleeson, who's a captain who's trying to kind of decide, like, kind of has these decisions to make, and none of them are ever, like, necessarily the best decisions. Like, do we let this many people die, or do we let this many people die? Do we go up into the mountains, or don't we go up into the mountains? And he, I mean, all the acting is spot on. The technical tricks are really, I mean, the long shots that Alejandro González Iñárritu is kind of almost known for now are there. There's specifically a bite scene at the very start where the Indians are killing the trappers. And you're like, oh yeah, this keeps going into each other and changing from POV to POV. It works. All the technical tricks work. I, again, felt like with this movie, the same way I kind of felt like with Birdman, I felt like it was more about the magic trick than it was about the film, because this, to me, was just a revenge movie, a vengeance movie that was kind of spread out and done lackadaisically throughout the this, you know, mountainous West territory. So... Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It has its merits. I just kind of felt throughout, you know, it got to the end, there was some bloodletting, like most vengeance movies has, and he didn't pull his punches.
No, he certainly doesn't.
No, he goes full for it. But at the same time, I just kind of still was like, okay, I feel like I've seen this movie 3,000 times, and this version even. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel anything particularly, nothing blew me away in this movie.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So
I would have thought that you would have been pretty into this on the sheer, violence scale of it. Cause it, oh my God, is it violent?
Like I said, it does not pull its punches. It's funny because sometimes I glaze over that and you're like, Richard, this is very violent. I'm like, oh yeah. Sorry.
It earns its R rating in the first 15 minutes, quickly. You talk about that long tracking shot and the kind of like how he, the fluid camera work that he implements throughout, sort of similar to some of the stuff we saw in Birdman.
Mm-hmm.
Although I would say that there's less of a,
maybe a little more bloody than Birdman, that's for sure.
Well, I'm just talking about the yeah, use of camera and the technique behind it. I think, but there is kind of an attention to what I think is actually kind of cool about the movie when they're doing these big set pieces, especially, is he keeps the audience in the center of the action. We're not looking at it like from a proscenium point of view, or we're the audience and it's kind of in the distance, or it's even done with traditional coverage. He like wants you to place you in the center of it with all this chaos sort of happening around you. I thought that first opening sequence mm-hmm. is the best kind of thing I've seen like that since the opening storming of Normandy Spielberg's
Saving Private Ryan.
That was like, even though very, very different movie, very even shot differently and everything, it had that same kind of like, whoa, like here we are.
Yeah.
You know, like a director going, I'm directing.
Again, and that's what I'm saying is, while I thought the magic, you know, the magic trick was very cool that he mm-hmm. that he performed, that the set piece was great, but that was the, you know, the first 10, 15 minutes. And then right. we're out in the wilderness trying to survive with Leonardo DiCaprio for another 2 hours.
I have more to say. Don't even worry.
Okay.
I just wanted to get the positives in on there because there is a lot to like here.
Yeah.
I think Emmanuel Lubezki is one of the greatest cinematographers ever.
True.
Famously, he's shot a lot for Terrence Malick as well. And in fact, there's.
Oh, I was going to say this film reminds me a lot of a Terrence Malick film. There you go.
Right. And this is the film I think that people who hated The New World, this is the film they thought they were going to go see.
I could see that. Yeah.
And it kind of has that look. And, you know, and Lubezki, his stuff is so, I mean, it's painterly. There are sequences, specific shots where I just like, God, that's beautiful. Like, you could just put that on your wall,
mm-hmm.
About every other scene. Like, it's a cinematographer's wet dream throughout the whole movie. Between him and Roger Deakins, who did Sicario, they're both nominated for Best Cinematographer, and it's a toss-up as far as I'm concerned. Like, they're both are beautiful in completely different ways. I had a hard time with this movie because I felt that it was a chore to watch.
You're not wrong.
I thought that this movie was so over the top. For so much of it, I was reminded of, and I posted as a joke on Twitter. I was reminded of an episode of South Park
mm-hmm.
where the boys go see, Passion of the Christ.
Sure.
And they never actually show the movie. They just show the kids watching it, like from the perspective, you know, like their perspective sitting in the seats
mm.
and you just hear in the background, ah, ah. Ah! And then they just walk out of the movie.
Sure.
Like, totally stunned and, like, throw up down there. There's a few things that, like, viscerally get to me as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And that is being dirty, like, being really filthy, being cold, and being wet. Like, I don't like scenes when people get pushed into swimming pools with their clothes on. Like, I can deal with it if the scene changes soon enough, but like it's kind of squicks me out, like the idea of being wet in clothes.
Oh my gosh.
And so
okay, keep going. I'm sorry. Just had a breakdown of laughter, just laughing at you right, as a person. Not a big deal.
The whole movie I was totally uncomfortable. And I think you're maybe sort of kind of supposed to be, but I thought that it's just so
well, it is when I say that it breaks away from the fantasy of the Western, it completely
breaks
from...
There's nothing romantic about it.
No, and I think, you know...
Although Lubezki's cinematography work kind of paints these vistas in a romantic way, but it's like, you know,
oh yeah, vistas are romantic, but surviving in them is hell. So, I mean, so this
that should be the tagline for the movie.
Well, yeah, I could probably write those. But for me specifically with this film, yeah, I don't disagree that the vistas are pretty. I mean, they did a lot of that Akira Sawa shot where they're looking back up at the trees.
Mm-hmm. There's that. I noticed that as well. The last sequence.
I wish I would have cut like a bunch of those.
I didn't mind that stuff because at least it was a break from the insane amount of like painful looking stuff. Like when Leonardo DiCaprio's like mauled by this bear and his skin is just like in fillets the whole movie, and he's drinking water and it's pouring down his bloody throat.
Well, he's earning his Oscar.
I think he's earning it a little hard. I actually think that this movie and his performance in particular is a little showy.
Oh, again, this is like very reminiscent of like how I would talk about Birdman. A very different film, yes. Yeah. But in a very similar way, I'm like, this is a magic trick. This is all this is. There's nothing really much to this behind.
No, I agree. I think that Tom Hardy's really good in it.
Oh, no, I think all the acting's pretty good. I mean, I do think Leonardo DiCaprio is very good in it, but yeah, I mean, what he's character...
I'm not so sure if he is.
See, well, that's because he was dirty. You're...
and covered in mud and ice and...
You don't like that. I'm just kidding.
Viscera. No, I think that if you had had somebody like a Christian Bale in that role, or like some, maybe like a... Like, I don't know, some, like, maybe like a Daniel Craig or somebody who just is a little bit more grizzled.
A little bit more grit. He's got that, like, baby quality to him.
Yeah, there's, even when he, like, has a Grizzly Adams beard and is, you know, covered in stitches and guts and whatever, like, he's, you know, trying to frump it up for the movie. I feel like he, as an actor... There are certain things I believe from him, and there's certain things I don't. When he tries to do this kind of like super physical acting, with the exception of the Quaalude scene from Wolf of Wall Street, which I think worked because it was a comedy set piece.
Sure.
In this movie, it's essentially the same performance. It's just not for laughs. I wasn't that into it, and I thought that I had a hard time ever really getting past the shock value of the movie. Like, I felt like the movie was so intense on trying to be intense that it kind of iced me out emotionally.
You felt, and see, I didn't feel intensity at all. Like, honestly, there was the fight scene at first and I was like a little, oh, this has got some pickup and move. But then once it gets to its, you know, surviving in the wilderness kind of thing, I think it kind of is lackadaisical. It just kind of.
Well, it's far too long.
Oh, yes. That's
like it's
about 2.5,
45 minutes. It could easily be 90 minutes to 2 hours.
Oh, and it should be. I mean, really, this type of movie should be. And I don't mean that as like, oh, you can't direct, you know, a longer movie of this sort. No, the type of movie you want to hold that tension and that you know, that visceral feeling. And this just loses it most of the time. There's these kind of really pretty cutaway shot dream sequences where he's kind of seeing things
a little bit more into his backstory, and I get those were inserts I think that were put in there specifically to ground us emotionally in the character, because otherwise there really isn't that much to do that.
Sure.
And I felt like they felt pretty tacked on in that way. Like, it was like somebody was like, why do we care about this guy? And he's like, oh, okay, well, I'll do these cutaways. I don't know, like I had a hard time really loving the film, although I appreciate it on a technical level. I think that everyone earned their money on this movie because it had to be a miserable shoot.
Oh, it was like they talk about it like in interviews.
Yeah, I'm sure this was like fucking Apocalypse Now level of torture on the set.
Well, that's what I was saying, that Leo, maybe not for his acting performance, because I think he should have won last year. Honestly, with A Wolf on Wall Street,
It was a better performance. Yeah,
I think he was better in it, and I think that he should have won because I think he literally gave the best performance that year. However, with this film, what I'm saying, when he earned it, I mean, he literally went out into the fields and snow and grime and muck, and he earned it like a working man earns his living.
Right. Yeah. He's like everyone in this film is lucky they didn't die of pneumonia.
Right. And I just, again, I've already basically, because I can, I don't feel like there's a lot to it either. And I feel like I can sum it up very easily and say it's a revenge film.
It doesn't necessarily, as far as on a plot level, there doesn't need to be a lot of ins and outs. Like, it's fine that it's sort of this elemental kind of thing. And you know, the end when, you know, when the swords finally cross, there is kind of a Kurosawa-like samurai-ish vibe to it.
For sure.
And that's kind of cool. But it doesn't have the poetry of Kurosawa.
Well, it just takes too long to get there. Even though the movie is
trying so hard to be kind of New Agey and poetic, this isn't Yuritu, I feel like. Like, Birdman, the reason why Birdman works for me a little bit better than the rest of his stuff is because at least it's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's well-written, and, you know, you have some good performances in there, and people kind of taking the piss out of each other. It's a satire. And it's a satire done by Inarritu, but it's at least there's thematically something a little bit more to hang on to. Whereas this, I feel, is more what he does, which is just these overbearingly melodramatic kind of masturbatory dramas.
Well, he has a problem being economical. He doesn't understand the word. And I don't mean – that sounds way more bitchy than I mean it. But it is true. I think that his movies take too long to get to the point. And with this film, I think it's very much part of its problem. Again, at a technical level, you can praise it all up and down and say it's great, blah, blah, blah. Acting wise, I don't have as many issues as you had. And I kind of get what you're saying as well.
Right. I don't think that Leonardo DiCaprio is bad. I just think he's a little miscast, and it's just so big. Mm. I mean, everything in the movie is so big. And I think that Hardy actually kind of plays that up.
Well,
and sort of knows how to. Everyone else.
Well, what I like about it is taking the piss out of that Western fantasy. Because, I mean, some of those films, it's like, okay, you might as well have, like, orcs and, like, stone rock monsters and whatever else in here. It makes sense. but with this one specifically, it does. And I think I would respond to this if this was done, like, in the 1970s in a specific style. Or even, you know, and not even spaghetti Western. I'm just saying, like, literally, like, a little bit darker and but it's just the length that it takes him to get to the point that you're just like, when he gets to that violent crescendo, you just go, oh, okay. Yeah, that's pretty much a revenge film.
And also, what's the buildup to that? I mean, because we've seen this level of violence throughout the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen him, like, cut open a horse and sleep in it.
He Star Wars that horse, yeah.
Yeah. And
I did feel like I felt the beats from other films in this movie a lot.
Well, I think you're kind of right in that it's sort of an anti-Western, mm-hmm. which even in and of itself is not the first one of its kind. But yeah, I'll just say this. Terrence Malick is not.
Nobody. I feel like anybody who tries to usually mime Terrence Malick doesn't do as good a job. And the reason is because they didn't spend 20 or 30 years as a fucking philosophy teacher. Like, there's a reason he does the movies he does. I mean, he has that capability. And you are too, you know, sometimes I want to get behind his work, but like most of the time I'm just not, I don't engage to it. And by the time I'm done, I'm like, okay, that's it. Okay,
I felt very similar to this to how I felt about Beautiful when I saw that, which is like gorgeous, good performances. I mean, Birdman, like I said, I liked a little bit more because at least it was funny.
It grew on
you. It
was
a little bit of a satire. But this, I don't know. Something didn't quite work for me. I was mostly just exhausted by the movie and grossed out.
Oh, yeah. I need to find more movies where it's just like visceral like that. You need to see more of that.
Where people are just in like utter agony the whole time and covered in ice and piss and whatever
else. Well, you won't let me show you the nightmare, so I have to find other ways to get my kicks from you. So
I wasn't scared. I was just like, ew, stop it.
No, I think we can agree that this isn't necessarily
I don't believe the hype.
Yeah, I'm not behind
it. I don't believe the hype. I have no problem with extreme violence and you know, Old West and whatever. It's just, I agree with you. I felt that it was kind of empty.
Well, the thing that I kept thinking about was like, man, I did think this literally in the middle of the movie, man, I really wish I was watching Blue Ruin.
Okay, but we got to move on. Let's go ahead and get into our Netflix homework, which you assigned me, Kill Me Three Times. It's an Australian film, I think, by a director named Kriv Stenders. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a crime comedy.
Yeah, kind of like a, like 19, to me it was like one of those 1990s kind of like crime comedy movies, where it's right. Mostly it a crime movie.
It reminded me a lot of, we talked about it last, on our Tarantino episode when I said that there was like these shameless Tarantino ripoffs that came out afterward.
Right.
This would fit really nicely in there somewhere between Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead and Boondock Saints. Okay, so the basic plot in here, and this is kind of an involved plot, but it's sort of told out of chronological order, but we're shown a lot of different perspectives of these group of individuals who are sort of screwing each other over for money or for sex or both.
Like wild things.
Right. And in the middle of it, we have Simon Pegg, who plays a sort of unconnected hitman who, or I shouldn't say unconnected, but uninterested party as a hitman, who's sort of drifting in and out of these different groups of domestic, betrayals that are going on. We have this, kind of wimpy dentist who's dating a femme fatale sort of assistant who's trying to knock off this rich woman so that they can pay off some loan sharks or some bad money that they owe to somebody. And she's
they're trying to collect insurance.
Yeah. And, she is married to a bar owner who, found out that, she's also cheating on a Hemsworth or cheating on him with a Hemsworth.
The Stephen Baldwin of the Hemsworths. Yes.
So we're kind of introduced to all these different characters in different timelines that sort of overlap and interweave in that sort of Pulp Fiction-y sort of way. What did you think of Kill Me Three Times?
You described it. It's, like I said, it's one of those, it could have been one of those Pulp Fiction knockoffs from the 1990s. I really kept thinking I couldn't place my like finger on the film, but I was like, man, this reminds me of something. And maybe it's just the like overall feeling of all those movies. Right. That being said, like there's a few performances that I think are a little better. I actually liked Teresa Palmer, the kind of bitchy dentist assistant, and Elisa Braga, who was the other one that they kept trying to kill repeatedly. Mm. I thought Simon Pegg was strangely miscast. I mean, he did fine, but he just, I didn't really get a lot from him in this.
That's interesting.
All the Mels were just kind of brooding and just kind of were there, I guess, except for like the police character.
Yes, actually, he was one of, if maybe not for me, the only performance that really stood out. Brian Brown, I think, is his name.
Yep.
He plays this kind of grizzled Australian police officer, kind of dirty cop. And at first, you don't think much of him at all. He's kind of in this goofy-looking mall security guard outfit. And then at one point, he turns on a dime, and I was like, wow. Like, for a movie that really doesn't need it or deserve it, he put a lot of power into his performance.
Well, yeah. What's funny is, like, the two, the dentist and the bar owner, they're both these, like, third-string action dudes. Like, I've seen them in other movies.
Yeah.
They just kind of sit there and brooding. They're no different than those characters in those movies. I mean, I don't mind them. They weren't necessarily terrible. And this film is just sort of a middling film. I can't say that it's like completely terrible or like I was like bored out of my mind, but I was just like, oh, okay, this is what you are. And like, I just, yeah, even from the get-go, I knew what I was in for. Like, there was nothing in my brain that was ever like, oh, well, we'll see. Like, I was like, oh, this is a middling, dark comedy action, maybe thriller kind of thing. And it doesn't do the comedy very well, like you've already kind of hinted at, and it doesn't, the action is sort of all right. And I actually don't think, one thing that I do think that it does okay is I think blending those stories together. Like I actually did never felt like, cause some of these ones that I've seen where they go out of order in the story, you actually don't get a very good sense of like sometimes I get a little confused on what parts are coming in, but this one was very, I thought that part at least blended and flowed pretty well. It's kind of just an unoffensive one of, you know, 90s Pulp Fiction ripoffs. Like there's not really much to it. I do think that Teresa Palmer and Elsa Braga did pretty decent. But that being said, it didn't really do that much for me. This is one of those weird Simon Pegg, not with some with doing some side project movies. I sometimes I don't know. Does he just need like a? Does he think he's Michael Caine or like what's going on?
He says yes to too many things.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Or it's between projects or whatever. I mean, I looked into this director to see what else he'd done, like why this movie's happening. And I guess he had done a few indies of note or whatever. I don't know. I neither liked or hated this movie. It just kind of was. I thought the dialogue was disappointingly stilted through most of the movie. There were some scenes of dialogue when I like tuned my ear to it, when I decided I'm going to actually listen to what they're saying. And it was like every single line was like one of the most cliched lines you could use in this type of movie.
True.
Over and over again with almost no break between it. Simon Pegg, I sort of appreciate him in the movie because he brings something to it. With the exception of Brian Brown, who I already said was really good. I think he like at least brings some levity to it and you know, he's the through line of all the stories, so he kind of ties everything together. But yeah, I don't know. I think he kind of sat there.
He kind of knew what he was in a little bit more. Whereas I don't think most of the other guys, I think they took it at really face value. And when you take a movie like this at really face value, like it's not going to completely work. Simon Pegg, it wasn't necessarily he was bad. He played his role and he did it fine with some smirk and charm and stuff like that. But what I'm saying is I just don't really feel like this was a good role for him.
Well, no, he is sort of above this movie. You get the vibe, even though he does kind of a lot of these kind of movies, especially when he's not working in American films. I know what you mean about it. There's the vibe to it that he's sort of slumming it here.
Well, I wonder if he's just like makes them on the off chance that one's like a cult hit or something. Because I know
a little hard to tell. Like I said, the director had some kind of praise early on. And there's a lot of these movies. When I used to work at the video store, there was a lot of these movies that would come out. This one's foreign, but like all those like Avi Lerner joints.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, you know, five or six really well-known actors and that are all in the same movie, but they come out direct to DVD and, you know, somebody's holding a gun on the cover.
Yeah, and there's sort of a action market for that, really, still.
Right, they're essentially like made for Redbox.
Yeah, and what I was saying with Simon Pegg is I don't mind when actors of his, like, I think he's a great comedic actor. I don't mind when they kind of try on some new shoes like this and try to see, you know, what does a new director have? Sometimes it's just not going to work. But at the same time, he gets to practice his craft, and I don't see anything very wrong with it. Again, this movie is so inoffensive that I can't really be like, oh, don't see it. But I mean, I guess if we're talking about Netflix and the way people, you know, seeing it at home and stuff like that, I guess if you're into like really into the movie Wild Things or I don't know. You want to see a knockoff Pulp Fiction. If you're into those.
Right.
I feel like you'd have to be like a 35 to 45 year old, but.
It's kind of throwbacky, but in.
Not necessarily.
Actually, I would say it's more just dated than anything else. Like it felt, you know, a lot like one of those kind of like Pulp Fiction knockoffs or like one of those Elmore Leonard movies that, you know, wasn't Jackie Brown or Out of Sight.
Sure.
like, I don't know. It or like a John Dahl movie without like the good writing. It was okay. I guess it was inoffensive, but that's probably the best I can say.
Yeah, I can't really recommend it too highly to anybody. I can just say, well, Simon Pegg's in it. He's not the only person in it,
Right, and he's not bad at
it. So if you're going for him, you know, there's probably other versions of something like this that you could find, but...
Right.
And
it's not too long.
It's not, yeah. Those are like the worst praises ever. It's not too long. It's okay. If you like this person, sure. No, right. It's I wouldn't really highly recommend it or even really recommend it. I just say it's there.
It's there.
Yeah.
Okay. Next week for the Netflix homework, I'm going to assign us Otto Preminger's Laura, which came out in the 40s, kind of a well-known film noir that I've never seen and I've always wanted to, and now it's on the Netflix queue.
Okay, sounds good.
If anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about this week, what's your favorite David Bowie performance? What did you think of The Revenant or Kill Me Three Times if you happen to see it or Laura? Go ahead and email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Like us there and you can see all the news items we post as well as any kind of updates about the show itself. Or you can, you know, message underneath the news items and kind of put in your 2 cents. We could read that on air. Go ahead and follow us on Twitter as well at jabberpodcast. We just hit the 100 follower mark today.
What?
Yeah, we have 100 followers on Twitter.
No, we don't.
They're almost all other podcasts.
Oh, I was going to say they're almost all robots. I was like, oh, that's good.
I'm sure we have a couple robots, and I'm sure that number will fluctuate. But now that we've reached 100, I feel like we'll float around there for at least a little while.
Oh.
Go ahead and leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, where we're also available to stream, as well as our main archives at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com. We're also available on Pocket Cast, Zune, and the Windows Podcast Network, as well as player.fm. You can read the movie reviews that I write weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can also read some of the content I provided for the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Check out Brad's lit zine called Panel and Frame at medium.com/panel-frame. He's still updating that, and he's trying to get a print version of it kickstarted or crowdfunded or whatever within the next month or so. So if he gets enough contributors involved, we might see maybe like a monthly or bi-monthly print subscription-based zine.
Like a zine, yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's fun.
Check out our friends out there who also do the podcasts, including Leland over at his comedy podcast, Dampercast, in Olympia, Washington. Check out Rod and Denise here in LA, their music podcast, The Listening Party. And also check out our friend Patrick in Detroit over his podcasts, Almost Educational and Make Dad Read Comics. And next week, I will be a guest on another music podcast called The Great Albums Podcast, talking about the Strokes' first album, Is This It? I'm recording that on Sunday. I suspect that'll be out, I don't know exactly, probably sometime within the next week.
Oh, sounds fun.
Until then, we'll talk to you next
week. Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.